Creation story. Just a few preliminary remarks or introductory remarks. Some of them will draw upon the stuff that we said yesterday. I think it's probably important to say that when the story is told, I'll make it personal. When I tell the story or when I use the story in ministry, face to face with the people of the parish, I am a pastor. When I prepare to tell the story, or when I study it, then I may be an exegete. Then I may be, as much as God gives me the ability, a student of the scripture, or a scholar. But there's a difference in those two roles, and we ought to keep those roles separate because of the purposes behind them. My exegesis and my studying of scripture and my studying of how it stood within its own time and what has changed in it since then, both in terms of interpretation and in terms of details that have been added to it, so forth and so on, is necessary. I need to do the exegetical study in order to learn what I... I was thinking that would be so dramatic. Have any of you ever gone white watering in a raft? It can be frightening. It's even more frightening when you're not in the raft. When you're going down, when you're plunging down, and you feel you have absolutely no control to stop yourself, but the waters are taking you where the waters will, and the waters give not a damn about you. They're rushing you along, and the rocks are coming at you at the same time, and they're spinning. Only move from that now to a sense that there isn't even banks to this creek, but all existence is this white water which is rushing on. And there isn't even an up or a down or gravity to hold you in the water, but it's blasting all over existence and you're caught in it. Can you do that? That's tehom. That is utter chaos, as we were talking about it before. And this is what God's breath began to blow upon. Oh, it's deeper than that, if you can understand. And this should bless your heart to know that God's breath blows upon this. Psalm 130. Out of the depths have I cried unto thee, O Lord. O Lord, hear my voice. Let thine ears be attentive to the voice of my supplication. Out of tehom, says the psalmist. And what does the psalmist mean by that word, tehom? Well, if you can visualize it, this is not right for me to say it, but it's a kind of a cosmography. The Hebrew would say that deepest of all things is the pit, which is called Sheol. It is the place of the dead. But at the bottom of the pit, which is the deepest of all things at all, runs the wild river called Tehom. And so when the psalmist says, out of the depths I cry unto thee, O Lord, the psalmist is saying, I'm crying to you, Lord, from as down as I can be. Tehom is despair. Tehom is hopelessness. Tehom is guilt and grief and sorrow. That's how we begin to understand it by our experience. Tehom is the moment when you sinned against your wife, the same sin for the 10th time, after you had said, I'll never do it again. But you did it, and you hate yourself for it. Tehom is that kind of guilt which is physical, caught in your gut and twisting there, and you don't know how you're going to get out of it. Out of the depths have I cried unto thee. Tehom is really something, isn't it? All right, and that's the beginning. That God's Spirit blows on that wild water, that wild, uncontrolled, and terrible spirit. And God said, let there be light. I wish at this point I could blow trumpets well. How should I say, let there be light? I think it would be good to put up a trumpet at my mouth and blare it so loud that it rang in your ears forever and you never forgot the sound of it. But that wouldn't be enough. It would be better if I could put that trumpet to my lips and follow you all your life long and continue to blow it at the back of your head. Whoa, let there be light. But that wouldn't be enough. I should be able to whisper it so gently that it's always there, it's always underneath all of your thoughts, always behind all of your feelings, that it was gentle, gentle at the back of your mind and in front of you. Because of what God was doing when God said, let there be light. I wish I could make it feel grand to you and gentle and merciful. First act of creation. God was not finding the right magic phrase. What did you think he was doing? I'm afraid sometimes our thoughts, if we really stop to think about it, were a little bit wrong. God was not finding the right magic phrase that would release light from its compartment somewhere and let it be free. Yet that's often how we think of it, right? You get the magic phrase, say the right thing, and then the right thing is going to happen. It was not a magical phrase. God was not naming it. That's a little bit closer to Hebrew concept, but he named the light later and he called it day. So he was not naming it. Okay? Neither was he doing this, and this, I'm afraid, is where most of us are. In our technological age, we feel first you plan, then you draw the plans, then you work it out in a factory or whatever. First you make a model, then you create the actual thing itself. He wasn't going through stages of creation of light either. It was not as though his mouth was a gun, and he said, let there be light, and over there was the light. There was no difference between the word and the light. And that's where we fall down in this age today. We always see a difference between the thought of creation and the thing which comes out the other end. There was no difference. People, will you hear it? The word was the light. When God said, let there be light, the saying was the light. There was no distinction. The word that he said was coming. If you could visualize it, I suppose, see the mighty head of God, see that mouth open up, and see light issue forth. Not from the sun. Not talking scientifically at all, and yet we are. Not from the sun, but from the mouth of God comes light. It's amazing. Now I say, I should have my trumpet or my whisper, and it should always be at your back, because God never ceased to say that word. That's our problem too. We say a word, and then the time is up, and then we knock that hood, and we go have coffee. We go on to something else. God never ceased to say it. God is still saying it. Not over and over again. Don't you know? You're living in that word. That's why it should be there all the time. No, not all the time. It was above time. If time is in a globe and below God, it's as though God is saying, right now, let there be light. And while he's saying it, there's Abraham, and there's Jesus, and there are we in Holden underneath that same word. Can you perceive that? I have the right to say that. Because again and again, human beings wake up to the fact that the light really was, is, always shall be. Right? In the beginning was the Word. And the Word, what Word? The creating Word, right? He said, let there be light. He said, let there be a firmament. So, that's the Word. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. It was in the beginning with all things. Nothing was created that was not created through that Word, and the Word was, no, and in the Word was life, and that life was, here we are, people, and that life was the light of the people. John knew what he was talking about. And then he goes on and he says, I'll tell you what, the darkness has never overcome that light. God is still speaking it. What an amazing thing. Jesus Christ! Oh, I forgot the 14th verse. And the Word was made, and the light was made, and the flesh... I messed up. And the life was made flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth. And then John isn't kidding. He says, and we beheld it. We beheld his glory. So then that same word which was spoken at the beginning continues to be spoken, not over and over again, but once for all time. And when we fail to hear it, or when we fail to see it, God says, all right, I'll do it another way. But it's the same thing, and I'm doing it the same way. I'll send Christ so that you can see the word which you have ceased to hear. Christ is that light which was spoken at the beginning. Can you understand the magnificence of the love of what God was doing then and continues to do over and over again? Oh, and then it's repeated. John is so careful about that. That word is repeated. Jesus says it himself in the 8th chapter of John, just before he has a terrible discussion with the Jews, as it says in John. He begins his discussion by saying this. He says, "I am the light of the world." I don't know if anyone understood what a claim that was. In other words, he is saying, "I am what was spoken first, before all time. I am the light of the world." What did you think light of the world meant? Candle? You think it meant a floodlight or something, so that you could, or maybe when you walk back to your chalet or your lodge, it means the flashlight, so you know where to walk? Is that what you made the light of the world? Man, this claim that Christ was making is, "I am the first principle of creation, and more than that, I am that by which creation came. I am the light of the world." And he puts it out of time, too. In that same chapter where he's having this discussion with the Jews, he tries to indicate that he's been a part of time all the way through. He talks about Abraham as though Abraham was his friend. They say, "What's the matter with you? You're not even 50 years old, and you lived when Abraham lived?" And Jesus then comes back with the same pronouncement, but in a different frame. He says, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, Abraham looked to see my day, he saw it and was glad." Or, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am." That's the light of the world talking. You see, he doesn't say, "Before Abraham was, I was." He doesn't use the past tense to say, "I've been around so very, very long, Bernice, that even though I'm here with you now, I can remember back to the time when Abraham was and back to the beginning." No, he says, "Bernice, here I am standing in front of you. You can see me, but before Abraham is, I am. I am right now before Abraham. And I'm not only right now before Abraham, I'm all the way back at the beginning. I am the beginning. Let there be light. Let there be the Son of God. Let there be love." Well, "I am too," is Christ's claim, isn't it, for deity. That's why they picked up stones to throw at him, because he used, because in the Johannine Gospel, which is in Greek, it uses the words ego, eimi, which in the Septuagint, in the Old Testament Greek, are the words for the name of God. Before Abraham was, hey ho, I'm God. Oh, one more. Oh, I don't know, we could go on and on with light, and I'm going to have to get off in just a second. But the very next chapter, you remember where Jesus and his disciples are walking along, and they come into a village and they see a blind man. They have a little bit of a discussion about why he is blind, and Jesus says, no, the only reason he's blind is so that the glory of God might be made manifest. And then he goes on to say, "And as long as I am the light of the world, as long as I am in the world, and as the light of the world, I have to do the work of him before the darkness comes when no man can work. Therefore, I, oh blind man, I'm going to give you light. I'm going to give it to you here." And then he spits on his eyes and puts some mud there and so forth, and then this guy can see. You know what that means? That word which is spoken at the beginning of time, "Let there be light," God speaks not just over the whole world and him personally, but he speaks it for you. He speaks it for you. Through Jesus Christ, you are given to see the light, that light, so that your old blindness can fall away and be washed so that you can see. That's how personal that is. I should have a trumpet, or I should be able to whisper that behind you all the time. Oh, but it'll come. Book of Revelation, the New Jerusalem, where there will need to be no temple and no sun, because the Lamb will be the sun. They will be the light. And that light will shine so clearly. This is what is beautiful to me. Let there be light. It encloses all time right to the very end. That light is the way by which I will know you. Right now I know you because these electric lights are shining, because there is this globe outside, the sun is shining in, and so I can see you kind of in the shadow. I can see you kind of on the surface. I can get your face a little bit from the light that shines on it. I only get really what you want me to see. I mean, because you put a smile on and so forth, and you may not be smiling in your heart at all. I don't know. But that light which God spoke at the beginning shall at the end be my means of knowing you from the surface to the soul. By that light shining, I shall know all things in that light. How shall I make you know that first act of creation, which rings and rings all down time because it was above time? I don't know. Let there be light. Can you see the fullness a little bit of that first act? And there was light. And God saw that it was good. Which is to say, it fits. It's what I wanted. Yeah, that's what I worked on. It's good. Blessings on you people. The light that God lays out for you and calls again and again unto you, and the light into which you shall enter, is good. It is exactly what God wanted until we screwed it up, but let's skip that for a minute. Oh, and now he creates something. Remember what I told you about form and void? What God does is he creates form and then he fills the form up. So what does he create now? It goes on and it says, in the evening and the morning were the first day. What does God create? What is the form he makes? God is responsible for time. That's how vast this creation is. Please open up your giddy little minds. Somehow or other we lock our God into something that is greater than him, and then we become pagan. We lock God inside of time. But the story says that God is outside of time, and that time itself is the consequence of God's creation. We people, we are in time. We have to move through the minutes. We have to move through the seconds to get somewhere else, or to get onto another day, month, year, century. But God is above time. And presently, right now, at this precise moment, for God, God is at my birth. He's watching me come out squalling in the face. But God is also hearing my prayers right now. And right now, he's answering my prayer. I may have to work my way through a week or maybe even several years to get to the answer which God is doing right now for my prayer. But he is answering it right now. And at this very instant, the same God who is at the beginning of time and at the end of time, that same God is at my death. Receiving me. How can you be a stranger ever when it is the same God always? That's why it is the same yesterday, today, and forever, because yesterday and today and forever are ours. Above time, which is eternity, is God's. Time. And then he fills it. This is the white water. This is the rushing water. This is Tehom. This is chaos. This is troubles. This is grief. This is all that stuff that I was talking about in the very beginning. Now watch how this might, in a certain sense, be visualized about what happens next. God makes a place. He makes time, and then he makes a place. And God said, let there be a firmament. That means a hard place. Let there be a roof. Let there be a ceiling. Something, if you could climb up on a ladder tall enough, you could knock on it and it would make sound. Like that. Let there be a firmament between the waters, these wild waters, this terrible thing. That which sometimes seems literally to consume you when you are in that despair or that guilt that I was trying to describe before. God can push it aside. And he can begin to cause order to happen in. Let there be a firm place between. And let this firmament divide the waters that are above from the waters that are below. Can you all see this? Maybe you have to crane your heads just a little bit in order to see it. And then having looked once, you'll know. And then you won't have to look again. Here is the firmament. What is he doing now? He who created time, that he might fill it with events, which is why, incidentally, God becomes a God of history, now creates space that he may fill it with, ultimately, life. And it was so. This firm thing was set there so that the wildness might be separated and a space might appear. A space for those things which may be both the will of God and may be the object of the love of God. Okay, and that firmament he called sky. Now you notice how different this is from the Nordic myth. In the Nordic myth, it comes of death, and it was a living thing beforehand. It was a skull. Sky was a skull. Ymir's skull. Here, the only living thing is God. And the sky is a protector or a helmet. It is something made special for what is about to follow, and it doesn't come out of death, it leads to life. It's almost as though you had the experience of building a house, and you knew that you were going to bring into that house somebody that you love. With what care you would put that house up and put a roof on it and ultimately put curtains on the inside for someone that you love to come. With what care God shouted back the waters, that's the way other writers talk about it, and demanded that they stay in their boundaries. And all of that with a purpose, and the purpose was Bernice. It's amazing. And as he goes on then, he begins to draw forth, he commands the waters back. Read Psalm 104 for a sense of it, or as I told you the other day, read Job for a sense of how God described the boundaries upon which people could live. He cried back the seas and put them into their places, and he brought forth from the seas the dry land so that it could stand up. Now he's beginning to order and to shape creation. And what we cry unto one another is, it's not accidental. It is not accidental. And if your soul dearly needs to know that the sun rose this morning partly on account of you, you may say so. Not because you're so wonderful, great, or beautiful, but because for some reason that I can barely fathom, God loves you. And so, earth, and then he calls, I'm going to go a little bit faster so we can get more in and not go so deep in. But earth, and then on the earth, he asks the earth to become generative, to bring forth and grow. And so here come the trees and the plants bear seed, and the trees have fruit in which is their seed. And the marvel of that thing is to say that God wasn't doing it just once, but what he did, he was setting in motion to continue and to continue. They should procreate. In his intelligence, what he was thinking about at the very beginning was all of time. And he was thinking about, I don't know why he would think about this, but he was thinking about lasagna. Lasagna in which there is no meat but spinach. Well, that's what it's meant. It means that there was a preparation for the feeding of the people that would come hereafter. He wasn't just making one tree and saying, isn't that a pretty tree? Aren't I a great God? It's amazing the things that I can do. He was saying, this tree is here for a purpose. The seeds are in it so that it may continue and continue and continue, that you might eat. Or that you might feast your eyes upon it. That comes in the second chapter. Every tree which is a delight to look upon. That you might just plain take pleasure in it. In other words, satisfy not only your stomach, but satisfy your eyes and your need for color and symmetry and for greenness. Huh? How much love in this creation? Well, and then also we have seas and we have land. And then long about the fourth day, oh, there's a war going on here. The teller of this tale, there's a war. Fourth day, God is going to put sun and the moon, or they're not even called sun and moon. Did you notice that? The way that teller tells the tale, the sun and the moon don't even have names. They're just called the greater light and the lesser light. That's all. Now, you may not know, but as that tale is being told, everybody put their hands up to their mouths and they laugh. Because other religions at that time, Babylonian religion, for example, named the sun and the moon, worshipped the sun and the moon, said they were living deities and called the sun Marduk or Ra. But when this story was told, they didn't even have a name. Because the only living being to be worshipped was God. That's all. And that's why when this storyteller comes along and says, well, okay, God slapped some lights into the heaven. He stuck one up there to rule the day, and he stuck one up there to rule the evening. And then in a subordinate clause, almost like an incidental accident, he says, oh, and he made some stars. And everyone said, ha, 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 where did we get them? Because the astrological religion said that those stars were influences and powers that directed the lives of the people. But by putting it into a subordinate clause, it was almost as if he sneezed the stars into place. Ha-choo! There they are. And the war is won. Well, and of course, you also see then This is why this writer wouldn't even care about saying whether light came from the sun or not. No, light came from God. Light was life. Light was order. Light was the space in which we might live and believe. All right. And so they're put up there. And what are they there for? No, they're not going to tell you. They are not going to tell you your astrology and what's going to happen to you today. None of you read that stuff, do you? What are you, Sagittarius? Virgo. See, nobody reads this stuff. No, whether you're Taurus or the crab. I know some crabs. That's where that comes from, don't you know? That stuff that we read in the newspapers and in where we are, they always put it on the comic page. And I read it. I really do. And when it's something good, I might start to believe in just a little bit. But hardly what I know. That's exactly what's happening here, where the sun and the moon and the stars receive no names whatsoever and no duties and no jobs. Their jobs are not to tell you what's about to happen. Although you see how tenacious that religion is, because it does continue today and people really can read your astrograph. And what they need is not just your birth date, but your birth time, down to the hour and the minute and the second. And if you give them those things, they still have all of the various instruments and mentality that they used to have, yea, centuries, millennia ago, to tell you when you're going to die and so forth and so on. But our story of creation says nuts to all of that. It says forget it, because the only job that the sun... There isn't even a job given to the stars. Later on, they are called the host of heaven, and we could talk about that, so forth and so on. But right now, no job. The only job given to the sun and the moon is to tell time and to divide the seasons. Oh, yes, and for signs. It does say that. That's squeezed in there. But not necessarily the astrographic signs. Rather, the signs of the times, if you will, and the signs of the seasons. Jesus talking about, you look up and you know what kind of weather is coming. All right, that's the fourth day. Oh, if I told this the way the fellow did who wrote this thing down, you would begin to get a sense of gravity and solemnity. It's like a poem, only it doesn't rhyme by sound, it rhymes by action. And each of these days ends, each of these days is a verse, and it ends in exactly the same way, and the evening and the morning were the fourth day. And they are again and again, good. Can you hear that echo of that sound? And it isn't just someone on the sideline saying, yeah, it looks okay. You drew it up true, God. It's God saying, my heart, good. This is good. It fits my will. This is as it ought to be. This is good. And the fifth day... And the fifth day, all of a sudden, everything begins to come to life, isn't it? All of a sudden, the waters begin to teem and to jumble. Now, what did I tell you? God makes a space. God makes a form, and then God fills the form. And now he has made the space, and he has made the time. That permits physical presences, and it permits motion. It permits events. And now he allows the physical presences to take upon themselves their own motion. And so all of a sudden, it's as though he says, and let the waters swarm with swarms. Let the waters teem. Let them become very full. And so these waters, which at one time might have been wild, now become protectors, and they begin to hold life, and life itself is generated in them, and the fishes come, and they begin to swarm everywhere. And all of this space here, which we call the air, begins also to be filled with life as well, so that there becomes no place where there is not life. The whole thing is filled with life, and still you're not there. It's all preparation. It's all waiting. And God says to these animals, hey, procreate, fool around. Have babies. I don't want it just for now. This is going to cross through all of time. When Bernice gets here, I want there to be one trout at least in the stream. Work on it. Don't quit. I bless you in that labor. It's a good labor. See? So there and then for all time. And then it's the same thing with the birds. They have that same kind of thing put behind them that they continue. And then the evening and the morning or the fifth day. Boom, boom. And here comes the sixth. The sixth day, the earth itself becomes a progenitating thing. God says to the earth, he said, I want you now to bring forth something. And so come the animals. And then the writer at that time gives us a kind of a scientific division. There come three kind of animals. Mollies, those that keep close to the ground,
the wild beasts, that is the undomesticated beasts, and at the same time the cows, the cattle, the domesticated ones. They all begin to crawl. If we put together the first and the second chapters, which we have a right to do, we say, as yet they are unnamed. It's important. As yet they are unfinished. In the Hebrew mind, what finally finished a creation was to give it a name, because when you gave it a name, you gave it a place. You gave it a place to be. You gave it a thing to do. I name you all Waitri. What does that word mean, Waitri? I know what it is. Anyway, I give you a place. You're a garbologist. Well, you know, and that, but in the Hebrew mind, to have given the name was to complete creation, because it fits you to the rest of all of creation. You began to know why you were here and what you are to do. You began to know your purpose and the value of your presence, but the animals didn't have that yet. Hold that, hold that. They were still uncreated, like crawling out and looking around for something to finish. It wasn't done yet. Okay? And then comes what this was all about. This is amazing. Bernice. God said, let us, well, this is a very important decision God is about to do, and it needs to be indicated that this is not like all the other things that were happening. God's going to sit down and think about this. Let us, and the us, don't you know, could mean that God is acting like a king, but it also might imply at the same time that this needs discussion. Let's talk about it. Let us make people in our image. In other words, this time I'm not only going to speak it, I'm going to shape it with a purpose, our image. Now, I guess the first writers, and if this is what you thought when you were children, you were not wrong. When they thought image of God, yeah, I have to tell you, they were probably thinking physically. That is to say, two legs and all that kind of stuff, and a face, and standing upright, as opposed to the animals. But ultimately, that's not what the Hebrews were thinking. Ultimately, that's not what Israel was. But we can do that when we're children. We can kind of anthropomorphize God and say that he walked around. They do that, right? And had arms and a mouth and emotions and so forth. But let us make this special creature, this created thing, in our image, means much more. Not just form, but content. What am I going to put in them? I'll tell you what. I'll put emotions in them, which means that they shall have the ability to love. That's special. I love. They may love. And if it works out, we'll love each other. How about that? Let's put reason in them. The ability to imagine things that don't even exist. The ability to plan something from its inception to its ending ever before they begin to start on it. To take a problem and to labor with that problem. Oh, let's put will in them. Emotions, reason for planning so that they can bring something all the way through, and will to perform it that they might choose. And here is the most terrible of all and the most loving. Let's give them freedom. What the tree was in the garden. It was an act of the love of God, and it was a terrible act of the love of God. It said, I'm not going to make puppets. I'm not going to grab them like maybe some parents would like to do and say, you love me, and if you don't love me, you don't get any food. Or I'm not going to make them so that they do love me, that I enforce in them some affection for me as the deity. I want love which is love, and love which is love must begin. It must have its inception. It must have its choice in the other being. I'm going to set them free. Oh, my God. So I'm going to put into the middle of this garden a tree, and that tree is going to be choice. I mean, I don't care if they eat a piece of that fruit as opposed to another fruit. What I do care is, will they obey me? And will they do it on their own recognizance? I'm going to set them free. That's why later on in the second chapter, God says, there is a tree there, and I don't want you to eat of it. That one. All the rest are a delight to your eyes. How many do you suppose are there, Adam? I count 3 billion. You think you need that one? All the rest are there to satisfy you. Just don't eat of that one. Okay? And then Adam said, like my children say, why? And God said, that's not the point.
Why?
Because I told you not to. That's all. Because we're talking about obedience here. Not talking about rationality or reason or you can figure this out for yourself. All I want is obedience. Just don't eat of that tree. But since you asked, in the day that you eat of it, you and I are going to begin to part ways. And since in me is your life, in the day that you eat of it, you shall begin to lose your life. Or let me put it as cold and bold as I can. In the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. Oh, that's why. Image of God is this, that God, it's the thing that parents hate to do, but the world forces them to do it. It's the time when you finally say unto your kid, okay, take the car. Or when the kid goes off to college or off to kindergarten, I don't know, you probably felt it over and over again, there they go. What are they going to do? They're going to kill themselves, I know it. I'm going to read about them in the paper. Caught smoking pot. You understand what I'm saying? How terrible and how deeply beautiful was this act of God to make human beings in God's image and thereby also to give us freedom that we might love. But with that freedom is always the possibility. It is not freedom unless, it is not obedience unless there is the opportunity of another choice, not loving or seizing our own way to go. Let us make Bernice in our own image. He must have sighed deeply at that. Just the way parents sigh when the child is gone and you're saying this one time, Gail, where are you? Gail? I thought I saw you come in the front door before. Gail with two daughters. There you are. Remember what you told me the other day?
Which time?
When you were walking back and you were going to bed and your daughters are going out to the jacuzzi?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? And what you wanted to say?
Well, it's getting late and you better be in on time.
And what you didn't say?
I just let them make their own choice.
Divine Gail. She let them be free. So that when they do come back, it's them coming back, not Gail snatching them back, eh? Okay. And all of creation for that. So God made the people. In God's own image, God made the people. Male and female made he them. I'm saying that carefully. Here we wash out of this myth some of the stuff that's been going on for centuries and centuries, and here we say, hey, look what the words say. What the words say is that the image of God is incomplete in Bernice. What we say is that the image of God is incomplete in Michael. What we do say is that the image of God is complete in Bernice and Michael. That's what makes it complete, the male and the female together. Because one individual alone is incapable of loving unless it's narcissistic. But a male and a female together can begin to perform the acts of God, like fooling around. It's an act of God. It's creative. Both in the beginning and in the end. Well, you understand that I'm not just joking. I really mean that. The image of God is not just in Walt Walker standing here fixed and pickled all alone. All I am is a male man. And there are parts of me that will ever and ever remain complete unless... Bam! That's a terrible way to do it. Unless... Yeah, that is... Unless my dear wife, out of her own recognizance and her careful wisdom, chooses also to love me. Is that better? That's the real one. All right. Do you understand then, though, this important matter, that the image of God can be complete finally only in an act? The image of, as God can do these things, God is whole in God's self,
But we human beings that are the creative become whole only when we are we human beings together performing the acts of love. And among those acts of love, yes, people, is sexuality and creativeness. Let's quickly jump to the second chapter real quick and stick that in. Step by step, two thoughts. One, that second chapter is so gentle and so right as we tell this story. God did not make us by accident, but God drew together the other things that God had already made, which had been procreative, the dust of the earth, the dirt of the earth, the loam, the clay. Incidentally, the word here for form man out of the dust of the earth, that word form is the same word that Jeremiah uses when he talks about pots of clay, that you form pots of clay that way. So God formed. And please take it that way. Lie down and close your eyes and be child and feel the fingers of God on your beginning, that is your face, your start, as you shall feel at the end. Feel those hands touch you and scallop out your cheeks and touch your temple. And make of your head a space and of your whole body a thing that might hold something else. Every part of your body took such care to know it and to form it. Just as you are, Adam, just as you are, Eve, God took that. And then that wasn't enough. That was the form, but it wasn't full yet. It didn't have anything in it. It was still void. There lay that giant Adam, empty for all of the beauty. So God filled up Adam with God's own breath, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, so that's your inception. And every time you breathe, you begin to realize that that's the presence and the will and the love of God. Can you see it? That breath itself, that soul, that spirit entered into you, and you participate in that very shaping life of God. What care and what love? Nothing else. What care and what love? Nothing else. What care else did he take such time as with your eyebrows and your lips and the birthmark on the back? But then, see, Adam wasn't complete alone. Male wasn't complete alone. So, two things. Yeah, I have to just let me touch this. Here is the good gift God gave Adam, that is to say, that God gave all of us, said, name the animals, huh? Remember what I told you what a name is? Here comes that beauty. When I was a kid, I used to think, what fun. Here comes this big bovine creature, horn sticking out. What am I going to call it? Cow. You're a cow. From now on, we'll call it a cow, people. Write it down, cow. No, this was extraordinary. What God was saying unto Adam was, come, child, participate with me in creation. Give it a place to be. And if you name it, then you have power over it. So you have dominion. You take care of it. You will draw. You will become its purpose. You become the purpose of creation, even as creation is for you. Name it and call it and let it be. Complete it. Finish it. And so Adam named the animals. But then that wasn't enough. And Adam was still alone. And so God made a help fit for Adam, perfectly fit for Adam. Made Eve. And this is the wholeness of the image that I was trying to tell you before. Now, they were without clothes, it says at the very end. They were naked, and they were not ashamed. Here is this image of God in act. What I would say for us today is that they were different from each other, Adam and Eve. They didn't even look alike. You take a little time to look at one, or you say, you got things I don't have. I got some things you don't have. Well, but here's the neat part. They fit. They fit together. They are perfectly fit for one another. See? And you don't have to be ashamed of that sexuality. Well, the larger point being is that every human being is different from another one. In this world of sin, the difference terrifies us. Right? Because where you have more power than I have, or more intellect than I have, I begin to be scared of you in our sinfulness. I think that you're going to use it over against me to hurt me. Or where I have some talents that you don't have, I can begin to use them over against you to hurt you. And so I don't like my vulnerability, but I do much like my power, and then that's the result of sin. But they were naked. That is, all the differences of intellect, talent, physique, everything hung out there. And they were not ashamed, because those differences is precisely how God wanted it, because when the differences got together, they made babies. They worked. They created. That's the image of God. That's the act of God. And they were naked and not ashamed. It's only when we put clothes on, you see, that we all wanted to be the same. We thought the only kind of relationship we could have was in homogeneity. We're going to identify none of our differences. You can't even tell if I'm male or female. And I'm going to wear jeans just like everyone else in high school wears jeans. And as soon as they get a certain kind of shirt, I'm going to get it. It's because I'm scared. But then this was God's intent, that maybe I might be naked and not ashamed. And God saw that it was good. The world, the peopling of the world, the body, the filling of the body. And that was the sixth day. And the seventh day was Shabbat, which comes from the Hebrew word rest. God created rest. Oh, and ordered the time. Do you notice most of our ways of dividing time are physical? The day by the sun, the month by the moon, the year by the sun, and so forth and so on. But where did we get a week? What happens every 7 days? What an odd.